Let us enter Jack Sawyer's kitchen. The morning's Herald lies unfolded on the dining table. A black frying pan recently sprayed with Pam heats atop the circle of blue flames from the gas stove's lower front left-hand burner. A tall, fit, distracted-looking man wearing an old USC sweatshirt, jeans, and Italian loafers the color of molasses is swirling a whisk around the interior of a stainless steel bowl containing a large number of raw eggs. Looking at him as he frowns at a vacant section of air well above the shiny bowl, we observe that the beautiful 12-year-old boy last seen in a fourth-floor room of a deserted New Hampshire hotel has aged into a man whose good looks contribute only the smallest portion to what makes him interesting. For that Jack Sawyer is interesting declares itself instantly. Even when troubled to distraction by some private concern, some enigma, we might as well say, in the face of that contemplative frown, Jack Sawyer cannot help but radiate a persuasive authority. Just by looking at him, you know that he is one of those persons to whom others turn when they feel stumped, threatened, or thwarted by circumstance. Intelligence, resolve, and dependability have shaped the cast of his features so deeply that their attractiveness is irrelevant to their meaning. This man never pauses to admire himself in mirrors. Vanity plays no part in his character. It makes perfect sense that he should have been a rising star in the Los Angeles Police Department, that his file bulged with commendations, and that he had been selected for several FBI-sponsored programs and training courses designed to aid the progress of rising stars. A number of Jack's colleagues and superiors had privately concluded that he would become the police commissioner of a city like San Diego or Seattle around the time he turned 40, and 10 to 15 years later, if all went well, step up to San Francisco or New York. More strikingly, Jack's age seems no more relevant than his attractiveness. He has the air of having passed through lifetimes before this one, of having gone places and seen things beyond the scope of most other people. No wonder Dale Gilbertson admires him. No wonder Dale yearns for Jack's assistance. In his place, we would want it too. But our luck would be no better than his. This man has retired. He is out of the game. Sorry, damn shame and all that, but a man's got to whisk eggs when he's got to have omelets, as John Wayne said to Dean Martin in Rio Bravo. And as my mama told me, Jack says out loud to himself, she said, "Sonny boy," said she, "when the Duke spoke up, every dang buddy listened up. Lessen he was a-grindin' one of his numerous political axes." Yes, she did. Them were her same exact words, just as she said 'em to me. A half-second later, he adds, on that fine morning in Beverly Hills, and finally takes in what he is doing. What we have here is a spectacularly lonely man. Loneliness has been Jack Sawyer's familiar for so long that he takes it for granted. But what you can't fix eventually turns into wallpaper, all right? Plenty of things such as cerebral palsy and Lou Gehrig's disease, to name but two, are worse than loneliness. Loneliness is just part of the program, that's all. Even Dale noticed this aspect of his friend's character, and despite his many virtues, our chief of police cannot be described as a particularly psychological human being. Jack glances at the clock above the stove and sees he has another 45 minutes before he must drive to French Landing and pick up Henry Layden at the end of his shift. That's good. He has plenty of time. He's keeping it together, the subtext to which is, "Everything is all right and nothing's wrong with me, thank you very much." When Jack woke up this morning, a small voice in his head announced, "I am a coppiceman." Like hell I am, he thought, and told the voice to leave him alone. The little voice could go to hell. He had given up on the coppiceman business. He had walked away from the homicide trade. The lights of a carousel reflected in the bald head of a black man lying dead on the Santa Monica Pier. No, don't go there. Just don't. That's all. Jack should not have been in Santa Monica anyhow. Santa Monica had its own coppice men. As far as he knew, they were a swell bunch of guys. though perhaps not quite up to the standard set by that ace boy, whiz-bang, and youngest-ever lieutenant of LAPD's homicide division himself. The only reason the ace boy and whiz-bang had been on their turf in the first place was that he had just broken up with this extremely nice, or at least moderately nice, resident of Malibu, Ms. Brooke Greer, a screenwriter greatly esteemed within her genre, the action-adventure-romantic comedy, also a person of remarkable wit, insight, and bodily charm. And as he sped homeward down the handsome stretch of the Pacific Coast Highway below the Malibu Canyon exit, he yielded to an uncharacteristically edgy spell of gloom. A few seconds after swinging up the California incline into Santa Monica, he saw the bright ring of the Ferris wheel revolving above the strings of lights and the lively crowd on the pier. A tawdry enchantment, or an enchanted tawdriness, spoke to him from the heart of this scene. On a whim, Jack parked his car and walked down to the array of brilliant lights glowing in the darkness. The last time he had visited the Santa Monica Pier, he had been an excited 6-year-old boy pulling on Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer's hand like a dog straining at a leash. What happened was accidental. It was too meaningless to be called coincidence. Coincidence brings together two previously unrelated elements of a larger story. Here, nothing connected, and there was no larger story. He came to the pier's gaudy entrance and noticed that, after all, the Ferris wheel was not revolving. A circle of stationary lights hung over empty gondolas. For a moment, the giant machine looked like an alien invader, cleverly disguised and biding its time until it could do the maximum amount of damage. Jack could almost hear it purring to itself. Right, he thought, an evil Ferris wheel. Get a grip. You're shaking up more than you want to admit. Then he looked back down at the scene before him and finally took in that his fantasy of the pier had hidden a real-life evil rendered far too familiar by his profession. He had stumbled on to the initial stages of a homicide investigation. Some of the brilliant lights he had seen flashed not from the Ferris wheel, but from the tops of Santa Monica patrol cars. Out on the pier, 4 uniforms were discouraging a crowd of civilians from breaching the circle of crime scene tape around a brightly illuminated carousel. Jack told himself to leave it alone. He had no role here. Besides that, the carousel aroused some smoky, indistinct feeling, an entire set of unwelcome feelings in him. The carousel was creepier than the stalled Ferris wheel. Carousels had always spooked him, hadn't they? Painted midget horses frozen into place with their teeth bared and steel poles rammed through their guts. Sadistic kitsch. Walk away, Jack told himself. Your girlfriend dumped you and you're in a rotten mood. And as for carousels... The abrupt descent of a mental lead curtain ended the debate about carousels. Feeling as though pushed from within, Jack stepped onto the pier and began moving through the crowd. He was half-conscious of taking the most unprofessional action of his career. When he had pushed his way to the front of the crowd, he ducked under the tape and flashed his badge at a baby-faced cop who tried to order him back. Somewhere nearby, a guitarist began playing a blues melody Jack could almost identify. The title swam to the surface of his mind, then dove out of sight. The infant cop gave him a puzzled look and walked away to consult one of the detectives standing over a long shape Jack did not quite feel like looking at just then. The music annoyed him. It annoyed him a lot. In fact, it bugged the hell out of him. His irritation was out of proportion to its cause, but what kind of idiot thought homicides needed a soundtrack? A painted horse reared, frozen in the garish light. Jack's stomach tightened, and deep in his chest something fierce and insistent, something at all costs not to be named, flexed itself and threw out its arms, or extended its wings. The terrible something wished to break free and make itself known. Briefly, Jack feared he would have to throw up. The passing of this sensation bought him a moment of uncomfortable clarity. Voluntarily, idly, he had walked into craziness, and now he was crazy. You could put it no other way. marching toward him with an expression nicely combining disbelief and fury, was a detective named Angelo Leone, before his expedient transfer to Santa Monica, a colleague of Jack's, distinguished by his gross appetites, his capacity for violence and corruption, his contempt for all civilians regardless of color, race, creed, or social status, and, to be fair, his fearlessness and utter loyalty to all police officers who went with the program and did the same things he did, which meant anything they could get away with. Angelo Leone's disdain for Jack Sawyer, who had not gone with the program, had equaled his resentment at the younger man's success. In a few seconds, this brutal caveman would be in his face. Instead of trying to figure out how to explain himself to the caveman, he was obsessing about carousels and guitars, attending to the details of going crazy. He had no way of explaining himself. Explanation was impossible. The internal necessity that had pushed him into this position hummed on, but Jack could hardly speak to Angelo Leone of internal necessities, nor could he offer a rational explanation to his captain if Leone filed a complaint. "Well, you see, it was like someone else was pulling my strings, like another person was doing the driving." The first words out of Angelo Leone's fleshy mouth rescued him from disaster. "Don't tell me you're here for a reason, you ambitious little prick." A piratical career like Leone's inevitably exposed the pirate to the danger of an official investigation. A strategic sidestep to a neighboring force offered little protection from the covert archaeological digs police officials mounted into records and reputations when the press gave them no other choice. Every decade or two, do-gooders, whistleblowers, whiners, snitches, pissed-off civilians, and cops too stupid to accept the time-honored program got together, rammed a cherry bomb up the press's collective anus, and set off an orgy of bloodletting. Leone's essential guilt-inspired paranoia had instantly suggested to him that L.A.'s homicide ace boy might be gilding his resume. As Jack had known it would, his claim of having been pulled toward the scene like a fire horse to a fire magnified Leone's suspicions. "Okay, you happened to walk into my investigation. Fine, now listen to me. If I happen to hear your name in some connection I don't like any time during the next 6 months, make that ever, you'll be pissing through a tube for the rest of your life. Now get the fuck out of here and let me do my job." "I'm gone, Angelo." Leone's partner started to come forward across the gleaming pier. Leone grimaced and waved him back. Without intending to do so, without thinking about it, Jack let his eyes drift past the detective and down to the corpse in front of the carousel. Far more powerfully than it had the first time, the ferocious creature at the center of his chest flexed itself, unfurled, and extended its wings, its arms, its talons, whatever they were, and by means of a tremendous upward surge, attempted to rip free of its moorings. The wings, the arms, the talons crushed Jack's lungs. Hideous claws splayed through his stomach. There is one act a homicide detective, especially a homicide lieutenant, must never commit, and it is this. Confronted with a dead body, he must not puke. Jack struggled to remain on the respectable side of the forbidden. Bile seared the back of his throat, and he closed his eyes. A constellation of glowing dots wavered across his eyelids, the creature, molten and foul, battered against its restraints. Lights reflected in the scalp of a bald black man lying dead beside a carousel. "Not you. No, not you. Knock all you like, but you can't come in." The wings, arms, talons retracted. The creature dwindled to a dozing speck. Having succeeded in avoiding the forbidden act, Jack found himself capable of opening his eyes. He had no idea how much time had passed. Angelo Leone's corrugated forehead, murky eyes, and carnivorous mouth heaved into view and, from a distance of 6 inches, occupied all the available space. "What are we doing here, reviewing our situation? I wish that idiot would put his guitar back in its case." And that was one of the oddest turns of the evening. Guitar? I don't hear no guitar. Neither, Jack realized, did he. Wouldn't any rational person attempt to put such an episode out of mind, to throw this garbage overboard? You couldn't do anything with it, you couldn't use it, so why hold on to it? The incident on the pier meant nothing. It connected to nothing beyond itself, and it led to nothing. It was literally inconsequential, for it had had no consequences. After his lover had sandbagged him, Jack had lost his bearings, suffered a momentary aberration, and trespassed upon another jurisdiction's crime scene. It was no more than an embarrassing mistake. 56 days and 11 hours later, the ace boy slipped into his captain's office, laid down his shield and his gun, and announced, much to the captain's astonishment, his immediate retirement. Knowing nothing of the confrontation with Detective Leone on the Santa Monica Pier, the captain did not inquire as to the possible influence upon his lieutenant's decision of a stalled carousel and a dead black man. If he had, Jack would have told him he was being ridiculous. Don't go there, he advises himself, and does an excellent job of not going there. He receives a few involuntary flashes, no more, strobe-lit snapshots of a wooden pony's rearing head, of Angelo Leone's distempered mug, also of one other thing, the object occupying the dead center of the scene in every sense, that which above all must not be witnessed. The instant these imagistic lightning bolts appear, he sends them away. It feels like a magical performance. He is doing magic, good magic. He knows perfectly well that these feats of image banishment represent a form of self-protection, and if the motives behind his need for this protective magic remain unclear, the need is motive enough. When you gotta have an omelet, you gotta whisk eggs, to quote that unimpeachable authority, Duke Wayne. Jack Sawyer has more on his mind than the irrelevancy suggested by a dream voices having uttered the word policeman in baby talk. These matters, too, he wishes he could send away by the execution of a magic trick. But the wretched matters refuse banishment. They zoom about him like a tribe of wasps. All in all, he is not doing so well, our Jack. He is marking time and staring at the eggs, which no longer look quite right, though he could not say why. The eggs resist interpretation. The eggs are the least of it. In the periphery of his vision, the banner across the front page of the La Riviere Herald seems to rise off the sheet of newsprint and float toward him. Fisherman still at large and nope. That's enough. He turns away with the terrible knowledge of having brought on this fisherman business by himself. How about in Staten Island or in Brooklyn, where the real Albert Fish, a tormented piece of work if there ever was one, found two of his victims? This stuff is making him sick. Two dead kids, the Freneau girl missing and probably dead, body parts eaten, a lunatic who plagiarized from Albert Fish. Dale insisted on assaulting him with information. The details enter his system like a contaminant. The more he learns, and for a man who truly wished to be out of the loop, Jack has learned an amazing amount, the more the poisons swim through his bloodstream, distorting his perceptions. He had come to Norway Valley in flight from a world that had abruptly turned unreliable and rubbery, as if liquefying under thermal pressure. During his last month in Los Angeles, the thermal pressure had become intolerable. Grotesque possibilities leered from darkened windows and the gaps between buildings, threatening to take form. On days off, the sensation of dishwater greasing his lungs made him gasp for breath and fight against nausea, so he worked without stopping, in the process solving more cases than ever before. His diagnosis was that the work was getting to him, but we can hardly blame the captain for his astonishment at the ace boy's resignation. He had escaped to this obscure pocket of the countryside, this shelter, this haven at the edge of a yellow meadow, removed from the world of threat and madness, removed by nearly 20 miles from French Landing, removed a good distance even from Norway Valley Road. However, the layers of removal had failed to do their job. What he was trying to escape riots around him again here in his redoubt. If he let himself succumb to self-centered fantasy, he would have to conclude that what he had fled had spent the last 3 years sniffing his trail and had finally succeeded in tracking him down. In California, the rigors of his task had overwhelmed him. Now the disorders of western Wisconsin must be kept at arm's length. Sometimes, late at night, he awakens to the echo of the little, poisoned voice wailing, "No more coppicemen! I won't! Too close! Too close!" What was too close, Jack Sawyer refuses to consider. The echo proves that he must avoid any further contamination. Bad news for Dale, he knows, and he regrets both his inability to join the investigation and to explain his refusal to his friend. Dale's ass is on the line, no two ways about it. He is a good chief of police, more than good enough for French Landing. But he misjudged the politics and let the Stadies set him up. With every appearance of respect for local authority, State Detectives Brown and Black had bowed low, stepped aside, and permitted Dale Gilbertson, who thought they were doing him a favor, to slip a noose around his neck. Too bad, but Dale has just figured out that he is standing on a trap door with a black bag over his face. If the fisherman murders one more kid, well, Jack Sawyer sends his most profound regrets. He can't perform a miracle right now, sorry. Jack has more pressing matters on his mind. Red feathers, for example. Small ones. Little red feathers are much on Jack's mind, and have been, despite his efforts to magic them away, since a month before the murder started. One morning as he emerged from his bedroom and began to go down to fix breakfast, a single red feather, a plume smaller than a baby's finger, seemed to float out of the slanted ceiling at the top of the stairs. In its wake, two or three others came drifting toward him. An oval section of plaster 2 inches across seemed to blink and open like an eye, and the eye released a tight, fat column of feathers that zoomed out of the ceiling as if propelled through a straw. A feather explosion, a feather hurricane, battered his chest, his raised arms, his head. But this never happened. Something else happened, and it took him a minute or two to figure it out. A wayward brain neuron misfired. A mental receptor lapped up the wrong chemical, or lapped up too much of the right chemical. The switches that nightly triggered the image conduits responded to a false signal and produced a waking dream. The waking dream resembled an hallucination, but hallucinations were experienced by wet brain alcoholics, drug takers, and crazy people, specifically paranoid schizophrenics, with whom Jack had dealt on many an occasion during his life as a coppiceman. Jack fit into none of those categories, including the last. He knew he was not a paranoid schizophrenic or any other variety of madman. If you thought Jack Sawyer was crazy, you were. He has complete, at least 99% complete, faith in his sanity. Since he is not delusional, the feathers must have flown toward him in a waking dream. The only other explanation involves reality, and the feathers had no connection to reality. What kind of world would this be if such things could happen to us? Abruptly, George Rathbun bellows, "It pains me to say this. Truly it does, for I love our dear old brew crew. You know I do. But there come times when love must grit its teeth and face a painful reality. For example, take the sorrowful state of our pitching staff. Bud Selig, oh, Bud, this is Houston calling. Could you please return to Earth immediately? A blind man could throw more strikes than that aggregation of wimps, losers, and airheads." Good old Henry. Henry has George Rathbun down so perfectly you can see the sweat stains under his armpits. But the best of Henry's inventions, in Jack's opinion, has to be that embodiment of hipster cool, the laid-back, authoritative Henry Shake, the chic, the shake, the shook of Araby, who can, if in the mood, tell you the color of the socks worn by Lester Young on the day he recorded Shoeshine Boy and Lady Be Good, and describe the interiors of 2 dozen famous but mostly long-departed jazz clubs. And before we get into the very cool, very beautiful, very simpatico music whispered one Sunday at the Village Vanguard by the Bill Evans Trio, we might pay our respects to the third inner eye. Let us honor the inner eye, the eye of imagination. It is late in a hot July afternoon in Greenwich Village, New York City. On sun-dazzled 7th Avenue South, we stroll into the shade of the Vanguard's marquee, open a white door, and proceed down a long, narrow flight of stairs to a roomy underground cave. The musicians climb onto the stand. Bill Evans slides onto the piano bench and nods at the audience. Scott LaFaro hugs his bass. Paul Motion picks up his brushes. Evans lowers his head way, way down and drops his hands on the keyboard. For those of us who are privileged to be there, nothing will ever be the same again. My Foolish Heart by the Bill Evans Trio, live at the Village Vanguard, the 25th of June, 1961. I am your host, Henry Shake, the Sheik, the Sheik, the Shook of Araby. Smiling, Jack pours the beaten eggs into the frying pan, twice swirls them with a fork, and marginally reduces the gas flame. It occurs to him that he has neglected to make coffee. Nuts to coffee. Coffee is the last thing he needs. He can drink orange juice. A glance at the toaster suggests that he has also neglected to prepare the morning's toast. Does he require toast? Is toast essential? Consider the butter. Consider slabs of cholesterol waiting to corrupt his arteries. The omelet is risky enough. In fact, he has the feeling he cracked way too many eggs. Now Jack cannot remember why he wanted to make an omelet in the first place. He rarely eats omelets. In fact, he tends to buy eggs out of a sense of duty aroused by the two rows of egg-sized depressions near the top of his refrigerator door. If people were not supposed to buy eggs, why would refrigerators come with egg holders? He nudges a spatula under the edges of the hardening but still runny eggs, tilts the pan to slide them around, scrapes in the mushrooms and scallions, and folds the result in half. All right. Okay, looks good. A luxurious 40 minutes of freedom stretches out before him. In spite of everything, he seems to be functioning pretty well. Control is not an issue here. Unfolded on the kitchen table, the La Riviere Herald catches Jack's eye. He has forgotten about the newspaper. The newspaper has not forgotten him, however, and demands its proper share of attention. Fisherman still at large in, and so on. Arctic Circle would be nice, but no. He moves nearer to the table and sees that the fisherman remains a stubbornly local problem. From beneath the headline, Wendell Green's name leaps up and lodges in his eye like a pebble. Wendell Green is an all-around comprehensive pest, an ongoing irritant. After reading the first two paragraphs of Green's article, Jack groans and clamps a hand over his eyes. I'm a blind man. Make me an umpire. Wendell Green has the confidence of a small-town athletic hero who never left home. Tall, expansive, with a crinkly mat of red-blonde hair and a senatorial waistline, Green swaggers through the bars, the courthouses, the public arenas of La Riviere and its surrounding communities, distributing wised-up charm. Wendell Green is a reporter who knows how to act like one, an old-fashioned print journalist, the Herald's great ornament. At their first encounter, the great ornament struck Jack as a third-rate phony, and he has seen no reason to change his mind since then. He distrusts Wendell Green. In Jack's opinion, the reporter's gregarious facade conceals a limitless capacity for treachery. Green is a blowhard posturing in front of a mirror, but a canny blowhard, and such creatures will do anything to gain their own ends. After Thornburg Kinderling's arrest, Green requested an interview. Jack turned him down as he declined the three invitations that followed his removal to Norway Valley Road. His refusals had not deterred the reporter from staging occasional accidental meetings. The day after the discovery of Amy St. Pierre's body, Jack emerged from a Chase Street dry cleaner shop with a box of freshly laundered shirts under his arm, began walking toward his car, and felt a hand close on his elbow. He looked back and beheld, contorted into a leer of spurious delight, the florid public mask of Wendell Green. "Hey, hey, Holly," a bad boy smirk. "I mean, Lieutenant Sawyer. Hey, I'm glad I ran into you. This where you have your shirts done? They do a good job. If you leave out the part about the buttons." "Good one. You're a funny guy, Lieutenant. Let me give you a tip. Reliable on 3rd Street in La Riviere, they live up to their name. No smashy, no breaky. Want your shirts done right? Go to a chink every time. Sam Lee, try him out, Lieutenant. I'm not a lieutenant anymore, Wendell. Call me Jack or Mr. Sawyer. Call me Hollywood. I don't care. And now he walked toward his car, and Wendell Green walked beside him. Any chance of a few words, Lieutenant? Sorry, Jack. Chief Gilbertson is a close friend of yours, I know, and this tragic case, little girl apparently mutilated, terrible things. Can you offer us your expertise? Step in, give us the benefit of your thoughts. You want to know my thoughts? Anything you can tell me, buddy. Pure, irresponsible malice inspired Jack to extend an arm over Green's shoulders and say, Wendell, old buddy, check out a guy named Albert Fish. It was back in the 20s. Fish? F-I-S-H. From an old-line WASP New York family. An amazing case. Look it up. Until that moment, Jack had been barely conscious of remembering the outrages committed by the bizarre Mr. Albert Fish. Butchers more up-to-date, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Jeffrey Dahmer, had eclipsed Albert Fish, not to mention exotics like Edmund Emile Kemper III, who, after committing 8 murders, decapitated his mother, propped her head on his mantle, and used it as a dartboard. By way of explanation, Edmund III said this seemed appropriate. Yet the name of Albert Fish, an obscure back number, had surfaced in Jack's mind, and into Wendell Green's ready ear he had uttered it. What had gotten into him? Well, that was the question, wasn't it? Whoops, the omelet. Jack grabs a plate from the cabinet, silverware from a drawer, jumps to the stove, turns off the burner, and slides the mess in the pan onto his plate. He sits down and opens the Herald to page 5, where he reads about Millie Kuby's nearly winning 3rd place at the big statewide spelling bee, but for the substitution of an I for an A in Apopanax, the kind of thing that is supposed to be in a local paper. How can you expect a kid to spell Apopanax correctly anyhow? Jack takes 2 or 3 bites of his omelet before the peculiar taste in his mouth distracts him from the monstrous unfairness done to Millie Kuby. The funny taste is like half-burned garbage. He spits the food out of his mouth and sees a wad of gray mush and raw, half-chewed vegetables. The uneaten part of his breakfast does not look any more appetizing. He did not cook this omelet. He ruined it. He drops his head and groans. A shudder, like a loose electrical wire, travels here and there through his body, throwing off sparks that singe his throat, his lungs, his suddenly palpitating organs. Apopanax, he thinks. I'm falling apart. Right here and now. Forget I said that. The savage Apopanax has gripped me in its claws, shaken me with the fearful Apopanax of its Apopanax arms, and intends to throw me into the turbulent Apopanax River where I shall meet my Apopanax. What is happening to me? He says aloud. The shrill sound of his voice scares him. Apopanax tears sting his Apopanax eyes, and he gets groaning up off his Apopanax, dumps the swill into the garbage disposal, rinses the plate, and decides that it is damn well time to start making sense around here. Apopanax me, no Apopanaxes. Everybody makes mistakes. Jack examines the door of the refrigerator, trying to remember if he still has an egg or two in there. Sure he does, a whole bunch of eggs, about 9 or 10, had nearly filled the entire row of egg-shaped depressions at the top of the door. He could not have squandered all of them. He wasn't that out of it. Jack closes his fingers around the edge of the refrigerator door. Entirely unbidden, the vision of lights reflected in a black man's bald head. Not you. The person being addressed is not present. The person being addressed is scarcely a person at all. No. No, not you. The door swings open under the pressure of his fingers. The refrigerator light illuminates the laden shelves. Jack Sawyer regards the egg holders. They appear to be empty. A closer look reveals, nested within the rounded depression at the end of the first row, the presence of a small, egg-shaped object, colored a pale and delicate shade of blue. A nostalgic, tender blue. Quite possibly the half-remembered blue of a summer sky observed in early afternoon by a small boy lying face up on the quarter acre of grass located behind a nice residential property on Roxbury Drive in Beverly Hills, California. Whoever owns this residential property, boy, you can put your money on one thing. They're in the entertainment business. Jack knows the name of this precise shade of blue due to an extended consideration of color samples undertaken in the company of Claire Evinrood, M.D., an oncologist of lovely and brisk dispatch, during the period when they were planning to repaint their then-shared bungalow in the Hollywood Hills. Claire, Dr. Evinrood, had marked this color for the master bedroom. He, recently returned from a big-deal, absurdly selective VICAP course of instruction at Quantico, Virginia, and newly promoted to the rank of lieutenant, had dismissed it as, well, maybe a little cold. "Jack, have you ever seen an actual robin's egg?" Dr. Evinrood inquired. "Do you have any idea how beautiful they are?" Dr. Evinrood's gray eyes enlarged as she grasped her mental scalpel. Jack inserts two fingers into the egg receptacle and lifts from it the small, egg-shaped object the color of a robin's egg. "What do you know? This is a robin's egg. An actual, in the words of Dr. Claire Evinrood, robin's egg, hatched from the body of a robin, sometimes called a robin redbreast." He deposits the egg in the palm of his left hand. There it sits, this pale blue oblate, the size of a pecan. The capacity for thought seems to have left him. What the hell did he do? Buy a robin's egg? "Sorry, no, this relationship isn't working. The Apopanax is out of whack. Roy's store doesn't sell robin's eggs. I'm gone." Slowly, stiffly, awkward as a zombie, Jack progresses across the kitchen floor and reaches the sink. He extends his left hand over the maw at the sink's center and releases the robin's egg. Down into the garbage disposal it drops irretrievably. His right hand switches the machine into action with the usual noisy results. Growl, grind, snarl. A monster is enjoying a nice little snack. Grrr. The live electrical wire shudders within him, shedding sparks as it twitches, but he has become zombified and barely registers the internal shocks. All in all, taking everything into consideration, what Jack Sawyer feels most like doing at this moment, when the red, for some reason, he has not called his mother in a long, long while. He cannot think why he has not, and it is about time he did. Robin me no red robins. The voice of Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer, the Queen of the Bees, once his only companion in a rapture-flooded, transcendent, rigorously forgotten New Hampshire hotel room, is precisely the voice Jack needs to hear right about now. Lily Cavanaugh is the one person in the world to whom he can spill the ridiculous mess in which he finds himself. Despite the dim, unwelcome awareness of trespassing beyond the borders of strict rationality, and therefore bringing further into question his own uncertain sanity, he moves down the kitchen counter, picks up his cell phone, and punches in the number of the nice residential property on Roxbury Drive, Beverly Hills, California. The telephone in his old house rings 5 times, 6 times, 7. A man picks up, and in an angry, slightly drunken, sleep-distorted voice says, "Kimberly, whatever the hell this is about, for your sake I hope it's really, really important." Jack hits end and snaps his phone shut. Oh, God, oh, hell, oh, damn. It is just past 5 a.m. in Beverly Hills or Westwood or Hancock Park or wherever that number now reaches. He forgot his mother was dead. Oh, hell. Oh, damn, oh, God. Can you beat that? Jack's grief, which has been sharpening itself underground, once again rises up to stab him, as if for the first time, bang, dead center in the heart. At the same time, the idea that even for a second he could have forgotten that his mother was dead strikes him, God knows why, as hugely and irresistibly funny. How ridiculous can you get? The goofy stick has whapped him on the back of the head, and without knowing if he's going to burst into sobs or shouts of laughter, Jack experiences a brief wave of dizziness and leans heavily against the kitchen counter. "Jive-ass turkey," he remembers his mother saying. Lily had been describing her late husband's recently deceased partner in the days after her suspicious accountants discovered that the partner, Morgan Sloat, had been diverting into his own pockets 3/4 of the income from Sawyer and Sloat's astonishingly vast real estate holdings. Every year since Phil Sawyer's death in a so-called hunting accident, Sloat had stolen millions of dollars, many millions, from his late partner's family. Lily diverted the flow back into the proper channels and sold half the company to its new partners, in the process guaranteeing her son a tremendous financial bonanza, not to mention the annual bonanza that produces the interest Jack's private foundation funnels off to noble causes. Lily had called Sloat things far more colorful than jive-ass turkey, but that is the term her voice utters in his inner ear. Way back in May, Jack tells himself, he probably came across that robin's egg on an absent-minded stroll through the meadow and put it in the refrigerator for safekeeping, to keep it safe. Because, after all, it was of a delicate shade of blue, a beautiful blue, to quote Dr. Evinrude. So long had he kept it safe that he'd forgotten all about it, which he gratefully recognizes is why the waking dream presented him with an explosion of red feathers. Everything happens for a reason, concealed though the reason may be. Loosen up and relax long enough to stop being a jive-ass turkey, and the reason might come out of hiding. Jack bends over the sink, and for the sake of refreshment, internal and external, immerses his face in a double handful of cold water. For the moment, the cleansing shock washes away the ruined breakfast, the ridiculous telephone call, and the corrosive image flashes. It is time to strap on his skates and get going. In 25 minutes, Jack Sawyer's best friend and only confidant will, with his customary aura of rotary perception, emerge through the front door of KDCUAM's cinder block building and, applying his golden lighter's flame to the tip of a cigarette, glide down the walkway to Peninsula Drive. Should rotary perception inform him that Jack Sawyer's pickup awaits, Henry Layden will unerringly locate the handle and climb in. This exhibition of blind man cool is too dazzling to miss. And miss it he does not. For in spite of the morning's difficulties, which from the balanced, mature perspective granted by his journey through the lovely countryside eventually seem trivial, Jack's pickup pulls up in front of the Peninsula Drive end of KDCUAM's walkway at 7:55, a good 5 minutes before his friend is to stroll out into the sunlight. Henry will be good for him. Just the sight of Henry will be like a dose of soul tonic. Surely Jack cannot be the first man or woman in the history of the world who momentarily lost his or her grip under stress and kind of halfway forgot that his or her mother had shuffled off the old mortal coil and departed for a higher sphere. Stressed-out mortals turned naturally to their mothers for comfort and reassurance. The impulses coded into our DNA. When he hears the story, Henry will chuckle and advise him to tighten his wig. On second thought, why cloud Henry's sky with a story so absurd? The same applies to the robin's egg, especially since Jack has not spoken to Henry about his waking dream of a feather eruption, and he does not feel like getting involved in a lot of pointless backtracking. Live in the present. Let the past stretch out in its grave. Keep your chin high and walk around the mud puddles. Don't look to your friends for therapy. He switches on the radio and hits the button for KWLA-FM, the UW La Riviere station, home to both the Wisconsin Rat and Henry the Sheik the Shake the Shook. What pours glittering from the cab's hidden speakers raises the hairs on his arms. Glenn Gould, inner eye luminously open, blazing through something by Bach. He could not say exactly what, but Glenn Gould, but Bach for sure, one of the partitas maybe. A CD jewel box in one hand, Henry Layden strolls through the humble doorway at the side of the station, enters the sunlight, and without hesitation begins to glide down the flagged walkway, the rubber soles of his Hershey Brown suede loafers striking the center of each successive flagstone. Henry is a vision. Today, Jack observes, Henry comes attired in one of his Malaysian teak forest owner ensembles, a handsome collarless shirt, shimmering braces, and an heirloom straw fedora creased to a fairly well. Had Jack not been so welcomed into Henry's life, he would not have known that his friend's capacity for flawless wardrobe assemblage depended upon the profound organization of his enormous walk-in closet, long ago established by Rhoda Gilbertson Layden, Henry's deceased wife. Rhoda had arranged every article of her husband's clothing by season, style, and color. Item by item, Henry memorized the entire system. Although blind since birth, therefore incapable of distinguishing between matching and mismatching shades, Henry never errs. Henry extracts from his shirt pocket a gold lighter and a yellow pack of American Spirits, fires up, exhales a radiant cloud brightened by sunlight to the color of milk, and continues his unwavering progress down the flagstones. The pink, back-slanting capitals of Troy Loves Mary Ann, yes, sprayed across the sign on the bare lawn, suggest that, one, Troy spends a lot of time listening to KDCU AM, and two, Mary Ann loves him back. Good for Troy, good for Mary Ann. Jack applauds Love's announcement, even in pink spray paint, and wishes the lovers happiness and good fortune. It occurs to him that if at this present stage of his existence he could be said to love anyone, that person would have to be Henry Layden. Not in the sense that Troy loves Mary Ann, or vice versa, but he loves him all the same, a matter that has never been as clear as it is this moment. Henry traverses the last of the flagstones and approaches the curb. A single stride brings him to the door of the pickup. His hand closes on the recessed metal bar. He opens the door, steps up, and slides in. His head tilts, cocking his right ear to the music. The dark lenses of his aviator glasses shine. "How can you do that?" Jack asked. This time the music helped, but you don't need music. "I can do that because I am totally, totally bitch rod," Henry says. "I learned that lovely word from our pothead intern, Morris Rosen, who kindly applied it to me. Morris thinks I am God, but he must have something on the ball because he figured out that George Rathbun and the Wisconsin Rat are one and the same. I hope the kid keeps his mouth shut." "I do too," Jack says, "but I'm not going to let you change the subject. How can you always open the door right away? How do you find the handle without groping for it?" Henry sighs. "The handle tells me where it is. Obviously, all I have to do is listen to it." "The door handle makes a sound?" "Not like your high-tech radio and the Goldberg variations, no. More like a vibration. The sound of a sound. The sound inside a sound. Isn't Daniel Barenboim a great piano player? Man, listen to that. Every note, a different coloration, makes you want to kiss the lid of his Steinway, baby. Imagine the muscles in his hands." "That's Barenboim?" "Well, who else could it be?" Slowly, Henry turns his head to Jack. An irritating smile raises the corners of his mouth. "Ah, I see, yes. Knowing you as I do, you poor schmuck, I see you imagined you were listening to Glenn Gould." "I did not," Jack says. "Please. Maybe for a minute I wondered if it was Gould, but don't even try. Your voice gives you away. There's a little whiny topspin on every word. It's so pathetic. Are we going to drive back to Norway Valley, or would you like to sit here and keep lying to me? I want to tell you something on the way home." He holds up the CD. "Let's put you out of your misery. The pothead gave this to me, Dirty Sperm, doing an old Supremes ditty. Me, I loathe that sort of thing, but it might be perfect for the Wisconsin Rat. Cue up track 7. The pianist no longer sounds anything like Glenn Gould, and the music seems to have slowed to half its former velocity. Jack puts himself out of his misery and inserts the CD into the opening beneath the radio. He pushes a button, then another. At an insanely fast tempo, the screeches of madmen subjected to unspeakable tortures comes blasting out of the speakers. Jack rocks backward into the seat, jolted. "My God, Henry," he says, and reaches for the volume control. "Don't dare touch that dial," Henry says. "If this crap doesn't make your ears bleed, it isn't doing its job." Ears, Jack knows, is jazz speak for the capacity to hear what is going on in music as it unfurls across the air. A musician with good ears soon memorizes the songs and arrangements he is asked to play, picks up or already knows the harmonic movement underlying the theme, and follows the transformations and substitutions to that pattern introduced by his fellow musicians. Whether or not he can accurately read notes written on a staff, a musician with great ears learns melodies and arrangements the first time he hears them. grasps harmonic intricacies through flawless intuition, and immediately identifies the notes and key signatures registered by taxi horns, elevator bells, and mewing cats. Such people inhabit a world defined by the particularities of individual sounds, and Henry Layden is one of them. As far as Jack is concerned, Henry's ears are Olympian, in a class by themselves. It was Henry's ears that gave him access to Jack's great secret, the role his mother, Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer, Lily Cavanaugh, had occupied in life, and he is the only person ever to discover it. Shortly after Dale introduced them, Jack and Henry Layden entered into an easy, companionable friendship surprising to both. Each the answer to the other's loneliness, they spent two or three nights of every week having dinner together, listening to music and talking about whatever came into their well-stocked minds. Either Jack drove down the road to Henry's eccentric house, or he picked Henry up and drove him back to his place. After something like 6 or 7 months, Jack wondered if his friend might enjoy spending an hour or so listening to him read aloud from books agreed upon by both parties. Henry replied, "Ivy divey, my man, what a beautiful idea. How about starting with some whacked-out crime novels?" They began with Chester Himes and Charles Williford, changed gear with a batch of contemporary novels, floated through S.J. Perelman and James Thurber, and ventured emboldened into fictional mansions erected by Ford Madox Ford and Vladimir Nabokov. Marcel Proust lies somewhere ahead, they understand, but Proust can wait. At present, they are to embark upon Bleak House. One night after Jack had finished the evening's installment of Ford's The Good Soldier, Henry cleared his throat and said, "Dale said you told him your parents were in the entertainment industry, in show business." "That's right. I don't want to pry, but would you mind if I asked you some questions? If you feel like answering, just say yes or no." Already alarmed, Jack said, "What's this about, Henry?" "I want to see if I'm right about something." "Okay, ask." "Thank you. Were your parents in different aspects of the industry?" "Was one of them in the business end of things and the other a performer?" "Was your mother an actress?" "A famous actress, in a way. She never really got the respect she deserved, but she made a ton of movies all through the 50s and into the mid-60s, and at the end of her career she won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress." "Henry," Jack said, "where did you clam up? I intend to relish this moment. Your mother was Lily Cavanaugh. That's wonderful. Lily Cavanaugh was always so much more talented than most people gave her credit for. Every time out she brought those roles she played, those girls, those tough little waitresses and dames with guns in their handbags, up to a new level. Beautiful, smart, gutsy, no pretensions, just lock in and inhabit the part. She was about 100 times better than anyone else around her. Henry, some of those movies had nice soundtracks, too. Lost Summer, Johnny Mandel, out of sight." "Henry, how did you told me? How else could I know? These little things your voice does, that's how. You slide over the tops of your R's, and you hit the rest of your consonants in a kind of cadence, and that cadence runs through your sentences." "A cadence? Bet your ass, Junior. An underlying rhythm, like your own personal drummer. All through The Good Soldier, I kept trying to remember where I'd heard it before. Faded in, faded back out. A couple of days ago, I nailed it. Lily Cavanaugh. You can't blame me for wanting to see if I was right, can you?" "Blame you?" Jack said. "I'm too stunned to blame anybody. But give me a couple of minutes." "Your secret's safe. When people see you, you don't want their first thought to be, 'Hey, there's Lily Cavanaugh's son.' Makes sense to me." Henry Layden has great ears, all right.